and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Nabil Biyayo on this live broadcast from Studio 14 this Wednesday, May 15th, 2024. Heavy clashes continue in El Fasher as the Rapid Support Forces tighten the siege of North Darfur's capital. And South Sudan lawmakers summon ministers over the country's worsening economic crisis.
The next result of the parliament will be in a resolution also passed by the House to write to the president that this minister has done A, B, C, D, and we feel he is not competent enough to run that ministry.
We will have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. We begin here in the United States, where the United States today announced fresh sanctions against two Rapid Support Forces commanders, Ali Yaqub Jibril and Osman Muhammad Hamid Muhammad, for their roles in leading RSF operations in Sudan's Darfur region. The RSF military operation in El Fasher, North Darfur, has endangered the lives of hundreds of thousands of civilians, prompting calls for immediate cessation of attacks by RSF, the Sudanese armed forces, and allied militias. The statement emphasizes the urgent need to remove obstacles to humanitarian access, which have left millions at risk of starvation. The statement highlights the Sudanese people's demand for peace and a return to civilian government, with the United States pledging continued support for the peace process and readiness to impose further measures against those perpetuating conflict, committing atrocities, or obstructing humanitarian access. Still on Darfur, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, is warning of a possible imminent massacre in El Fasher, the capital of North Darfur state. Clashes have intensified between the Sudanese army and the paramilitary rapid support forces around the town. El Fasher stands as the sole major town in Darfur, yet to fall under the control of the rapid support troops, and has served as a haven for hundreds of thousands of displaced people fleeing violence in the region. I interviewed Suleiman Baldo, Director of Sudan Transparency and Policy Tracker. He began by highlighting the recent capture of Melit, another strategic town in North Darfur state, by the RSF as it tightened the siege on El Fasher.
The town of Melit is in North Darfur, and it is an important trade crossroad, not only between Sudan in the areas that are controlled by the Sudan armed forces, but also for border trade with southern Libya and northern Chad. And goods that arrive in Melit are then distributed throughout Darfur through the movement of trade. Melit is also a crossroad for all kinds of illicit economic activities, such as human trafficking, trafficking of weapons, and illicit commodities such as chemicals, cosmetics that are banned in Sudan, drugs, tramadol, and other very harmful drugs are known to have crossed between the borders into Sudan through northern Darfur. The Rapid Support Forces controlled the city as of mid-April as part of its siege of El Fasher. And the military takeover of Melit underscores all these layers of hidden dimensions of the war economy with regard to control of trade routes, but also control of the illicit economies that come with the forces that are present in this important crossroad for trade and for transnational organized crimes between North Darfur and neighboring countries.
And now El Fasher itself, after months of siege by the rapid support forces and skirmishes on the outskirts of the town, it seems heavy fighting has broken out. Artillery shelling has been reported in the last at least 3 days. The RSF seems to be determined to move in. Just tell me about the implications of a possible RSF takeover of this very important town.
Well, the implications are already happening. Both SAF and the RSF are notoriously known for the imprecision of their artillery shelling or even aerial bombardments of the Sudan armed forces. And therefore, civilians are caught in the middle and our casualties in large numbers are occurring as we speak due to these artillery duels between the SAF and the RSF. However, a total offensive and incursion by the besieging forces of the RSF into the town will create even more mayhem and destruction and civilian casualties. This is a town of 1.5 million people at least. Half of them are displaced from earlier wars and more recent developments in the current ongoing war between SAF and the RSF. And therefore, these are helpless civilians already on the verge of starvation who find themselves target of this fighting, you know, as they are caught in the middle of it.
Linda Thomas-Greenfield, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, she tweeted yesterday, and I quote her here, Al-Fashir Darfur is on the precipice of a large-scale massacre. I urge the armed actors to de-escalate and protect civilians at all costs. And she went on to warn of consequences for those responsible for an offensive on Al-Fashir. What should the international community do to prevent a massacre?
I believe the international community should coordinate its action better than in the case at this time. Even within the U.S. administration, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations have been far more outspoken about the situation there than, you know, Secretary of State Blinken, for example, who doesn't seem to have, you know, much focus on this humanitarian disaster unfolding, you know, in Darfur and in, you know, the Al-Fashir in particular. We demand that, you know, Secretary Blinken step to the plate and make, you know, clear statement about specific consequences that could, you know, hit the belligerents if they continue on this course of open warfare and its, you know, a helpless civilian population of hundreds of thousands who will be the primary victims of their fighting. And they will be, you know, they need to be determination to follow up with action and not just warnings and expression of dismay as has been happening so far from State Department.
That's Suleiman Baldo, Director of Sudan Transparency and Policy Tracker, speaking with me earlier today from the U.S. state of New Jersey. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken announced in September that war crimes had been committed by both sides of the conflict in Sudan, adding that members of the RSF and allied militias have committed crimes against humanity and ethnic cleansing against non-Arab communities in Darfur. Rights groups have also made similar allegations. Both parties denied the accusations made against them. And still in Sudan, over 25 million people across Sudan, South Sudan and Chad are trapped in a spiral of deteriorating food security, with at least 17 million in Sudan. The World Food Programme says the war in Sudan is creating the world's largest hunger crisis, and warring parties in Sudan are preventing aid from reaching people. VOA's Kim Lewis spoke with Matilda Vu, advocacy manager for the Norwegian Refugee Council, about the humanitarian crisis in Sudan and the looming famine.
The humanitarian situation is really worsening by the day. Right now, there's a conflict escalation in Darfur and probably what is going to be one of the most horrific and biggest battle of Darfur is currently happening in Al-Fashir, where there is millions of people basically trapped, people who are hungry, people who have no access to basic services. And, you know, over the weekend, there's been fighting in the streets, heavy artillery, airstrikes, even hitting the hospital, the pediatric hospital, and people fleeing, but who have basically nowhere to go. So this is in Darfur, but across the country, there is clashes. There are people hungry, people fleeing, and every week is worse than the other.
And one of the biggest problems is getting the aid to the people, and it appears that the warring parties are not allowing the humanitarian organizations to do this. So why are they stopping the flow of aid?
Yes, humanitarian access and humanitarian space is completely obstructed by parties to the conflict. We're not able to bring assistance from one side of the country to the other. We're facing a lot of restriction all across. And really, the people who are suffering the most are the civilians that have been waiting for food aid, cash, assistance, medical aid, shelter, and they've just left with themselves. The only people that manage to reach them are the people that are already there. For example, local respondents who are in conflict zone and who are running, you know, small soup kitchens, small shelters, small medical facilities that are able to support. But this is really a drop in the ocean compared to what is needed. As to why those obstructions are happening, I have no idea. What I know is that this is against international humanitarian law. And frankly, it's against like every single aspect of humanity when you have an entire country that is facing such a catastrophic level of suffering and of hunger.
Yes, and it's also spilling into South Sudan and even Chad, and there's a looming famine. But yet the international community does not seem to be as focused on this looming famine there.
There's a looming famine in Sudan. There is the largest displacement crisis when you look at Sudan and the region. And yes, it's, I have to say, like what is in common, the common point between Sudan, South Sudan, Chad, Ethiopia, Central Africa, is that they are all being forgotten. And that the people who are suffering, the people who are fleeing this war in Sudan, are completely neglected. I think it's been a year, more than a year now, that the war started, and the international community has really failed to gather as a group around Sudan, trying to. They haven't really applied the right pressure, the right diplomatic pressure to the parties to the conflict so that there is a de-escalation. And then especially if they haven't shown the right level of solidarity to Sudan and to Sudanese people, because, for example, only half of the humanitarian appeal has been committed to by different donors in Paris a few weeks ago. And there's a lot of rich countries from the G20, for example, that are not pitching in. And it's still very much insufficient compared to what is needed.
Mathilde Wu, Advocacy Manager for the Norwegian Refugee Council. She was speaking with my colleague Kim Lewis. And we move to South Sudan, where hunger is also looming and living costs rising on a near daily basis. The South Sudan Transition National Legislative Assembly agreed to summon 11 ministers of the economic cluster next week, but an economist doubts the move will change anything. Denis Logoni reports from Juba.
Humanitarian organizations warn severe hunger has been exacerbated by refugees arriving from Sudan. A recent World Food Programme report predicts over 1.6 million children and 870,000 pregnant and breastfeeding women and girls in South Sudan will face malnutrition in 2024, surpassing 2023 levels. Last week, lawmaker Stephen Boldeng noted his constituents in Mayom County are resorting to eating wild fruits due to flooding and lack of food. The assembly acknowledged widespread hunger caused mostly by the economic crisis, which prompted the summoning of the economic cluster. Parliament spokesperson Oliver Mori expressed optimism about summoning the ministers, but added Parliament is ready to take additional steps if certain resolutions are not implemented.
We go very slowly, but we follow the law. If it reaches that stage, then the next result of the Parliament will be in a resolution also passed by the House to write to the President that this minister has Dano A, B, C, D, and we feel he is not competent enough to run that ministry.
Economist Akima Ajieth says instead of summoning ministers, committees should utilize the president's directives to tackle the economic situation.
I am not sure whether the summon is what really will solve this problem, because they have been summoning these people for every time and then nothing changes. I still believe we have not actually sat down and defined exactly what is it that is the problem, whether it is us or the global economy change, global challenges or regional challenges. We have not defined exactly what is our problem. What is it that economy of South Sudan is not growing, rather it is actually declining. I would really like our parliament to go back to the speeches of the president and from there draw out what the president said his government will do. This way you can account these ministers, not only economic cluster, the service cluster, the youth and sport cluster, the governance cluster.
Patrick Youssef, the ICRC Regional Director for Africa, is urging the South Sudan government to support communities impacted by Sudan's conflict.
I do understand that there's a depreciation of the South Sudanese pound, there's an inflation. I'm sure you pay your loaf of bread double the price of what you used to pay before, but that again is no reason not to make a space for life-saving funds to be able to continue running the primary healthcare centers, the hospitals, the county hospitals, the teaching hospitals, but also providing food and water. I also call in these exceptional circumstances on the government to also take part in that exceptional situation. We cannot only look at our donors and ask for more funds. These donors have been quite active over 15 years of continuous response.
Ambassador Timo Olkonen, the European Union's head of delegation, warns of future crisis if the government doesn't act.
I have served in Africa for many years, and though people have it tough in many places on the continent, I have not witnessed anything like the tenacity of the South Sudanese. The recent economic downturn has made life even more difficult for many, and I know that it falls on those that still have salaries and income to support an even larger number of family or extended family members who have fallen on tough times. And of course, we have the more than 650,000 people who have arrived after fleeing the war in Sudan. It is a massive burden for this country.
The Bank of South Sudan has attributed forex exchange market fluctuations to external shocks and has announced additional monetary policy measures to address demand. But Ajieth says those new monetary policies won't make much of a difference.
You know, economic projects, they don't turn over so quick. They take time to develop because you do what is called incubation. You incubate it until it grows. So you have to have patience to grow it. I feel like some of the things we are doing, maybe for public consumption, but there is no action that I think is coming so quick. 320, 330. From 170 within less than 2 months. Every moment, the central bank releases a statement after statement, and then nothing improves. So that means that these statements, they don't mean anything. Nobody adheres to them. Nobody listens to them.
The South Sudan economy relies overwhelmingly on oil production, but measures to revamp it, including borrowing, face public criticism for lack of transparency. The 11 ministries summoned to address hunger and economic instability include the Minister of Finance and Economic Planning, the Minister of Petroleum, the Minister of Agriculture and Food Security, and the Minister of Trade and Industry. For VOA News, I'm Dennis Logonyi reporting from Juba.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, we look at what women are doing in rank to combat gender-based violence. Stay tuned.
Hello, listener of South Sudan in Focus. We have an exciting new segment dubbed Words of Wisdom. We want to hear your thoughtful proverbs that echo through your community. This is another chance for you to share wisdom from your roots. All you need to do is record a proverb in a language of your choice, tell us its English translation and what it means. Keep it brief, authentic, and represent your community. Your recorded proverb shall be sampled on South Sudan in Focus every Wednesday. Send your recording via our WhatsApp number, +1 202 630 8011. That is +1 202 630 8011.
And our proverb this week is from the Azande land.
Edeni Stevens says the training in Reng empowered her.
Apologies for that mix-up. Women in rank in South Sudan's Upper Nile State, equipped with new skills from training on gender-based violence, are optimistic about combating GBV in their communities. The training initiative, supported by South Sudan Women United, also aims to extend support to Sudanese refugee women facing GBV and suffering mental trauma from the one-year conflict in their country. Mamer Abraham Court reports for VOA from Malakal.
Edeni Stevens says the training in Reng empowered her with the skills to confront gender-based violence in her community.
The thing that I know about the rights of women and the violence that has been taken away. It's important to get the rights of women if the violence that is taken about her, to solve that problem, if there is a problem about the member of the family, in order to make solution for this problem, if there is something happening in the family, or there is a violence that is taken about women.
Another trainee, Noura Bair, is eager to provide support to victims and spread awareness in her community.
We give them awareness, like when something happens, they can report to the office or police and visit the hospital for the medical checkup before 3 days lap. Maybe someone who did that to you is sick. Yes, it is necessary to get early treatment.
She adds that they will also be able to help women recover from past traumas, particularly those who fled the war in Sudan.
We offer them with some need. We teach and keep them happy so that they forget their miserable past, especially the war they escaped. So we keep them engaged, happy, and inform them. That is the way of life. When you are among the people, forget all your hardship and happy with everyone.
Tina Stephen underscores the importance of reporting abuses and providing assistance to Sudanese refugees. She says she and her colleagues have learned a range of skills to help vulnerable women.
We must help women, especially those coming from Sudan, and provide them necessity for instance. If someone is having mental problem, as the South Sudan women, we assist them with their need. Also, girls who are facing are those that affect their mental well-being. We take them to the center for 3 days, including those with other diseases. We also assist women in various ways. For example, we keep them busy with handwork, such as tailoring and knitting, that help them overcome stress.
Paul Gare, Program Manager for South Sudan Women United, notes that GBV often is rooted in economic and social inequality for women.
We have seen that this kind of inequality centers on men and women, so it's a primary cause of gender-based violence. For instance, the belief that women should be economically dependent on men, and that women and children are a man's possession under his control. So we have seen this kind of thing that women should be aware of, such that they will be able to assert themselves or actually protect themselves.
He says South Sudan Women United aims to create service centers that help women on a variety of issues, including helping them report attacks and to provide them emotional support. For VOA News, this is Mamera Bramcourt reporting from Malakal, Upper Nile State.
With South Africa's general election just 2 weeks away, some polls suggest the governing African National Congress, or ANC, could get less than 50% of the vote for the first time in 30 years. Mounting criticism of the party that led to the fight against apartheid under the late Nelson Mandela has chipped away at its support, raising the possibility of a coalition government. My colleague Yahia Suhib asked David Monda, political science professor at City University of New York, if the polls indicating the demise of ANC are correct, and if he believes there is a cohesive opposition merging in South Africa to take on the ANC.
I think a number of things have happened, but I think the biggest challenge for ANC has been erosion of public trust in the ANC as a party that can deliver on its promises. That's number one. But I think the second element of it is people have lost faith in its capacity to govern, because it's now been over 30 years since democracy in the early 90s. Things have gone from bad to worse.
You are right, Professor. You know, the stubbornly high unemployment, which hit almost 32% last year, persistent economic inequalities, corruption allegations, and frequent power cuts have reduced its popularity. But the ANC says it is working to fix these problems.
Yeah, it can say that, but as they say, the truth of the pudding is in the eating. People need delivery on these promises. So part of the, you mentioned there, part of the what they call load shedding, the power cut, have been connected to corruption, lack of investment in the public utilities, in Eskom, which is one of the largest power utilities in South Africa over many years. And the other one has been state capture. There was a whole commission run a few years ago which showed massive corruption, particularly within the Zuma administration. But thirdly, we cannot also discount what we'd call white flight. So a lot of the white minority who have become fearful of a new black government, a lot of them have left the country. People with talent have moved to Europe, Australia, New Zealand, and the U.S. And then, of course, this level of high inequality, even if there's some small level of economic growth, because South Africa has the highest levels of income inequality, a lot of the benefits of any type of economic growth will be slow, and they'll usually only benefit the higher echelons of the economic food chain. So these are multiple problems that South Africa has faced. And I might add, in conclusion, also on the continent and also in the world, South Africa's soft power diplomacy has really been hurt with the xenophobic violence towards other black Africans from the rest of the continent who've been attacked over the years. I think this has really dented South Africa's image, not only on the continent, but also around the world.
And Professor, the main opposition Democratic Alliance, DA, taking advantage of ANC's weaknesses, the ones you just enumerated, says the country is in crisis, but it wants to liberalize the economy, including a move towards greater privatization. It has pledged to create 2 million new jobs. The rate of violent crime, they want to reduce it by half. Let's talk a little about the opposition here.
Yeah, so I think part of the challenge with South Africa now has been the dominance of the ANC over the years. They had almost a super majority in parliament. So I think this has made the ANC very lethargic. But when you look at the opposition, they don't have enough power to be able to significantly challenge the ANC. The DA that you mentioned, the main opposition party, is very strong in the Western Cape region of South Africa, but they're not very strong in the rest of the country. And there's also a big perception that the Democratic Alliance, the DA, is a white party. So there's a kind of a phobia around that, which doesn't really lend to, you know, them getting a lot of support. The other parties, like the EFF, like the Pan-Africanist Congress, they're small, they're very fractured, and ideologically, they don't sit very well with the DA. So I think this is another challenge for South Africa, the fact that you do not have a united, cohesive opposition that can take on the ANC.
That was David Monda, political science professor at City University of New York, speaking by phone with Yahia Suhib. And that's all we have for you this Wednesday. Don't forget to check out voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you missed this broadcast, go to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. I am your host, Nabil Biagio, in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer Keela, thanks for taking the time to be with us. Remember to join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
I believe I've survived for a reason to tell my story to touch life. All people struggling down there. Storms only come for a while, then after a while, they'll be gone. Bless. Bless. My father was working for the government as a policeman.